From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. At first, it was a run-of-the-mill disaster. Whenever Mother Nature has a fit of indigestion, reporters are dispatched to stand in her mouth.
Guys, we are in store for one nasty storm. Stay inside.
That was Kimberly Kurth of WKRG-TV reporting Monday from Mobile. She could have filed that same report last year or the year before from North Carolina or Florida. There's a script for hurricanes. As the winds gather, so do reporters. Then the hurricane hits, or it doesn't. The media move on with the eye of the storm, leaving reports of cleanups and damage estimates in their wake. Monday night, CNN's Aaron Brown was following that script.
Everyone, when Katrina finally slammed onto land, it wasn't quite the monster everyone feared, not quite. But it was fierce by any measure. A Category 4 hurricane that pummeled three states has done an extraordinary amount of damage.
But the script blew away with the storm. Katrina moved on, but in her wake, rising water overwhelmed the levees of New Orleans, filling the city like a bowl of soup. Fox's Shepard Smith on Tuesday.
The city has no power, no water, no stores, no restaurants, no food, no sanitary services, and no prospects for any of those things for weeks or months to come.
It's mind-boggling.
CNN's Jack Cafferty on Wednesday.
You find out every day that the story is bigger, much sadder, much more tragic than you thought it was the day before. Monday, we sat here while the winds blew and the rains came down, and we saw pieces of flying debris and reporters standing up, out in the high winds. And we thought to ourselves, or at least I did, okay, it's another hurricane. We've seen shots like this 100 times before.
But as New Orleans was inundated and overwhelmed, so were the reporters.
And by today, the death toll is beginning to approach something in the thousands, and I'm almost afraid to come to work tomorrow.
On ABC's Good Morning America, anchor Charles Gibson asked his colleague Robin Roberts, reporting Tuesday from her home state of Mississippi, about her family.
Mom's okay, sister's okay?
They're all right.
And the house?
Not so good, but it's okay. They're fine, and just so many people, so many people affected by this storm who can't get to the loved ones.
But the reporter's personal story seemed of a piece with the coverage. For a moment, everyone seemed to be related. True, as the waters continued to rise, media critics wondered why reporters seemed to shun the obvious observations about race and class, the multitude of black faces who lacked the means to get out in time, why there was so little comment on measures not taken to protect the region, since a catastrophe of this scale had long been predicted, why there was so little consideration of politics. By week's end, reporters were just beginning to broach some of those risky questions, but the safer route for the TV news outlets, if not for the reporters, was to sidestep the crucial question of whether it had to happen this way and focus on the evacuees, the chaos in the city, and, as in this interview broadcast early this week on CBS, the unbearable sadness of it all.
Who was at your house with you?
My wife.
Where is she now?
Can't find her body. She gone.
You can't find your wife?
No, she told me everywhere. She told me. I tried. I hold her hand tight like I could. And she told me, you can't hold me. She said, take care of the kids and the grandkids and my kids.
What's your wife's name in case we can put this out there?
Tony Jackson.
Okay, and what's your name?
Hardy Jackson.
Where are you guys going?
We ain't got nowhere to go, nowhere I'm going. I'm lost. That's all I had. That's all I had.
The first criticisms of the coverage, especially in the treatment of race, were unsurprisingly on the web. Early in the week, two Newswire photos started showing up all over the net. One of them captioned, "A young man walks through chest-deep floodwater after looting grocery store." And the other, "Two residents wade through chest-deep water after finding bread and water from a local grocery store." The pictures were nearly identical, except that the subject in the first photo, the supposed looter, was black, and the couple in the second, the finders, were white. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Slate media critic Jack Schaefer, among others, accused TV of skirting one of the most obvious aspects of the story, that blacks in New Orleans were more directly hurt than were whites. In fact, wrote Schaefer, nearly every rescued person, temporary resident of the Superdome, looter, or loiterer on the high ground of the freeway seen on TV was black, with no questions about race asked or answered. Boston Phoenix media critic Mark Jurgowitz has been following the coverage, and he agrees.
Schaefer's own assertion here and his own theory is they're afraid of making a comment that might be seen as politically incorrect or too candid or too controversial that could actually do damage to their career. My own theory here is the racial piece of this is still not the most important piece of the story right now. The first priority is to still essentially gather the facts on this evolving and geometrically expanding disaster. And to the extent that broadcasters seem squeamish about dealing with these issues, I would just say that it evinces the obvious, which is that 40 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, that race is still the third rail in American culture and society, and we are not comfortable talking about it, even in obvious situations.
Well, if there's an indictment, then wouldn't it be that we spend so little time really trying to get to the root of these issues in our ordinary course of coverage that when we see a disaster scenario, when the nature of urban black poverty and all of its ramifications, you know, hits us right between the eyes, we somehow are awakened from our comfortable slumber to want to scream into the heavens about it. But for heaven's sakes, this isn't the time because there's people underwater and there's much more urgent life or death issues to deal with as reporters right now. Isn't the right thing to pay attention to the natural catastrophe and its consequences and try to do a better job of dealing with the race issue under normal circumstances?
Well, there's no prohibition about, and here's where I think journalism falls a little short, about folding in what we should know about urban America and poverty and places like New Orleans, folding that into some of the 24/7 coverage. I mean, for all the importance that's placed on the developing story, let's face it, the cable networks are going 24/7. Somewhere in those 24 hours, there's time to talk about this issue. The great newspapers of America have a lot of space, and many of them are giving 4 or 5 pages every day to this story. Somewhere, there's time for a sidebar or an analysis piece about this. All it would take, frankly, would be for news organizations to be confident enough, you know, both of their facts and of their politics, to be able to sort of give some of the social context to what people are constantly seeing. As they are watching the tens of thousands of people in the Superdome or leaving the Superdome, a discussion of why they tend to be so predominantly black. As they're looking at looting scenes, a discussion of the racial makeup of the city, of the police department, you know, some kind of perhaps a delineation between people trying to feed their families and people who are actually criminals. That could all be part and parcel of the ongoing coverage, not the lead story, but part of what we should be talking about, because people are seeing images now that I think in their own minds are starting to cement perceptions that are not being dealt with very adequately by the ongoing coverage.
There have been some observers on the political right who've argued that the press is actually paying too much attention to class. Jonah Goldberg, in his National Review blog called The Corner, he calls this the reflexive playing of the class card and writes, "Whatever happened to the idea that unity in the face of calamity is an important value? We're all in it together, I guess, except for the poor who are extra special."
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of a conservative polemic by people who, I mean, everybody here is trying to figure out, what do I write about this? And I think ideologues on the left and the right have sort of been scraping the bottom of the barrel a little bit. I don't think there was anybody who walked into coverage of this story, all these reporters deployed, with a sense that we are going to see a story that's largely going to be about the poor, about the disenfranchised, about African Americans. They went down to cover a natural disaster. This is fundamentally a story about race and class for one reason, as far as I can tell, and that is that certain people were able to heed the warnings and get out of the city ahead of time because they had the ways and the means and the wherewithal, and a number of people were unable to get out of the city because they didn't have the ways and the means and the wherewithal, and that's essentially the story we're looking at. Suddenly, a natural disaster seems to be disproportionately affecting people who I would say don't get their share of day-in and day-out news coverage, and I think that's what's particularly unusual.
Have you discerned a divide in the way this story has been covered between TV and print?
You know, not as large a divide as you would get on most stories of this magnitude, I think. I mean, normally, you basically get the quote-unquote breaking stuff on television, you know, the powerful pictures of what's happening right now. And newspapers, which are no longer in the breaking news business fundamentally, are there to do analysis, interpretation, take you deeper. You know, on Thursday, I read stories that started showing up in places like the Washington Post and the New York Times that started talking about some of the political implications of this disaster and whether there would be a political backlash for President Bush and whether or not this could call into question, for example, his priorities, you know, too much money being spent on the war in Iraq, what happened to National Guardsmen, all that sort of stuff. Now, that's the kind of sort of split off story that you would expect sort of the print press to get involved with earlier. And I think you're seeing some of that that you're not necessarily seeing on television. But right now, the enormity of this catastrophe, the fact that it's still incredibly fluid, I think has basically the ink-stained wretches and the guys with the microphones, you know, chasing the same fundamental story, which is just trying to figure out the breadth and the width of this disaster.
How about highlights and lowlights? Have you seen anything particularly appalling to you or particularly heroic by reporters on TV?
I think there's been tremendous heroism on the part of journalists down there who have literally put themselves in harm's way. It's interesting, the photographer and the photo editor who was responsible for writing the caption that said the white or lighter-skinned people who were coming away with the groceries had found those groceries as opposed to the black man who looted it, was on a blog today essentially reacting to all this sort of criticism that he was getting. What he said to his critics was, please talk to me later. He said, I haven't had solid food for 3 days. I can't find my family. Everything I have down here is destroyed. I've never been in such hellish personal conditions in my entire life. And I wrote that caption, and I'll be happy to talk about it in the future, but right now I'm just trying to survive and hope that my city is trying to survive. I think everybody that's been involved in covering this story has put themselves at risk, even if it means just wading around in that filthy water. I mean, that's a different life than the people who are sitting back in newsrooms in Washington, New York, and Boston and analyzing what's going on, which includes myself.
Okay, Mark. Thanks very much.
Hey, Bob. My pleasure.
Mark Cherkowitz writes about media for the Boston Phoenix.
Coming up, the view from the eye of the aftermath and the escalating war over regulating content on TV and cable and the internet.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Among the evacuees from the flood on Tuesday was much of the staff of the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Huddled in the back of a newspaper delivery truck, they quickly relocated to a temporary newsroom in Baton Rouge. Jim Amos is the editor of the Times-Picayune, and he joins me now. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So give me some of the nuts and bolts about how you're doing your job, how you're communicating with your reporters, and how you're communicating with your readers.
The communication with the reporters is perhaps the most difficult because all the modern tools we've all come to rely on have broken down. It's no longer second nature to just pick up a cell phone because the cell phone won't connect. We've had to improvise, but we've been publishing the newspaper without interruption on the internet in PDF form, including on the day, Tuesday, the day after the storm, when we trekked over 6 hours out of the torrents of New Orleans and through southwest Louisiana.
The newspaper that you've been publishing online includes at least partly a kind of a blog, doesn't it? Consistently updated with short news pieces and dispatches from readers?
Blogging is an absolutely essential part of this whole effort. And yeah, it informs the stories, and we harvest from it for the stories as well as from our own reporting. And it also is an important link to readers. And our readers are scattered in a huge arc across the South, having fled the city. And one thing we're doing beginning tonight is putting out our first print edition in the hopes that we'll be able to reach many more people who haven't had access to the online version of the newspaper.
You're talking about Thursday night. Will the biggest problem be getting it into the city?
Well, distribution is going to be a gargantuan task, yes. And we will be distributing it in the parts of the city that are accessible to us and also places to which we know our readers have evacuated, shelters, hotels. Baton Rouge has become a virtual New Orleans in exile. It's, the population here has swelled hugely, and we know it's our audience.
You said one of the biggest problems was communicating with your reporters. Do you find you lose touch with them from time to time? Do you worry about where they might be?
I worry, especially our reporters who've penetrated to some of the really inaccessible parts of New Orleans and really cannot be reached. Today we heard from a reporter who had found his house and was using it as a base from which to report, and then heard reports that there were armed gangs roaming his neighborhood and his life was threatened. And we finally were able to get him to safety. Another reporter was dispatched to the Gulf Coast to cover that side of the hurricane, and we have not heard from him yet, and we are terribly fearful as to what has happened to him.
I can't imagine that there would have ever been a story where the reporters would be so much participants. Probably some of them are homeless. I wonder how that affects the reporting.
Oh, I would say the majority of us are homeless. I mean, that's almost the predicate condition of being here. I am surrounded by the most courageous journalists in America, and it's utterly sustaining to be among them and to be working side by side with people who are committing fantastic journalism, even as they don't know what has happened, in some cases, to their own families, people who have lost everything.
Are there elements of this story that you know that only the Times-Picayune can really cover because you know the city so well?
Well, I think every day there are aspects of our reporting that could only spring from an intimate and longstanding knowledge of the city and all its idiosyncrasies and peculiarities. Inevitably, the national media will be focused on the best-known tourist spots of New Orleans, the French Quarter, and that will blind you to what's happening in the rest of the city. On the very afternoon of the storm, I think we were the first to notice that the water was rising even after the storm had gotten quite out of our area, and we had two reporters return from their neighborhood. They had ridden to it in bikes, and they had observed the torrents coming through where the canal had been, and that was the beginning of the reports that the aftermath was worse than the storm itself and the real inundation was just beginning. And that is something that you couldn't have expected a national media to observe.
What's the story that you've been trying to get all week that you just can't get at?
There still are parts of the city that are just right now terra incognita to us. We just can't get to some parts. And the Mississippi Gulf Coast, I think, is a tale of disaster that is yet to be fully told. And we're, of course, always balancing our storytelling ability with our willingness to put our reporters and our photographers in great danger.
What do you want people outside of New Orleans to know about your city that hasn't really been conveyed in the coverage so far?
Well, I think inevitably the coverage focuses on the most spectacular observable events. And in the case of the past 2 days, the most spectacular observable events have been the horrible looting and the lawlessness in the streets. And so I imagine that some people must have the impression that this represents New Orleans. I think it's important for the nation and the world to understand that this city is a great national and world treasure inhabited by wonderful people who want to rebuild it and make it better than ever.
The story is how to rebuild the city, whether to rebuild the city, what to do with this unprecedented group of American refugees.
Yeah, it's an experiment in reconstituting itself that will have to be invented hour by hour, day by day. And our task is to chronicle it.
Once this immediate crisis passes, the national press will turn its attention elsewhere. But for you, for the Times-Picayune, this story is really just beginning, isn't it?
This story is just beginning. It will preoccupy us deeply for quite a long while. And you're right, long after the immediate national focus has shifted.
Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Jim Amos is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune.
Remember the V-chip? It's an electronic circuit wired into the guts of your television that can be used to filter out shows you deem offensive. Recently, a group of media companies has banded together to better publicize the device, which seems awfully altruistic. After all, why would CBS want to help us block CSI? The answer? They hope to show that parents are better arbiters of taste than Uncle Sam, who appears to be gearing up to clamp down on decency standards not only for broadcast, but also for basic cable and satellite radio. Michael Shearer, Washington correspondent for Salon.com, says the newly appointed FCC Chairman Kevin Martin is among those leading the charge.
He's replacing Michael Powell, who for a long time was the boogeyman for people like Howard Stern. But Kevin Martin actually has a track record that's much more strict about issues of indecency. Actually, for a long time, he's been saying that cable networks and satellite television providers have to do something about the kind of content that's going over basic cable. In the Senate, the biggest player right now is Senator Ted Stevens, who's one of the most powerful senators, has been for a long time, just took over the Commerce Committee, which oversees these issues. And it's expected in the next several weeks or couple months that he's going to bring up some legislation that will deal with possibly indecency fines, raising the amount of money that broadcast networks can be fined, and also possible regulation of things like basic cable or a changing in the way cable is delivered so that parents will have more choice, families will have more choice about what channels they take into their home.
Now, opponents of stricter regulation are mobilizing. One of the better financed groups is a motley assortment of organizations, including Americans for Tax Reform, the Creative Coalition, and various media conglomerates, all under the name TV Watch. So what are they up to?
They're arguing essentially that there's technology in place right now, things like the V-chip, which you mentioned, or other blocking technology that parents should be using right now, and there's no need for the government to go any further and stepping in to block anything.
If people were using the V-chip, but most families are not.
And the conservative critics say that it's too complicated, and they also say that on an almost ethical, moral grounds, they don't want to be paying for content they find objectionable. What the V-chip allows you to do is to block the station from coming through your television, but you're still essentially paying for that station on your cable bill. You're still paying to get the whole basic cable package.
I think there's a reflexive tendency to reject notions of government censorship of any kind. But some of the programming is pretty objectionable to a pretty broad swath of America. Are there any surprising voices speaking up in behalf of those who are looking to the FCC or other government entities to protect their children?
Well, some of the consumer groups, for instance, which aren't usually finding themselves allied with the evangelical right, have joined on in a call for what's called a la carte cable, which is a way of providing cable so that each household would be essentially able to choose exactly which channels they want to be getting as part of the basic cable package. You also have the discussion of television ownership, media ownership in general. One of the complaints that some people on the left have made for a while is that if you have fewer companies owning more stations, you're going to have less diversity in programming and less ability to respond to the needs of a particular community. So some of the progressive groups have been making some uneasy alliances and not complete alliances. They're trying to figure out where they stand on a lot of these issues.
Can a show be so popular that the government has no grounds upon which to restrict its content? I'm thinking of CSI, which some people are very concerned with because of the graphic and grisly images that appear on that show. On the other hand, it's one of the runaway blockbuster hits of broadcast television.
I don't think popularity alone would keep them from restricting the content. The definition of indecency that the FCC uses has to do with certain sexual and bodily functions being employed during a certain time of the day when kids are likely to be watching or listening to the broadcast, and also has to do with sort of a dreaded, ambiguous phrase, contemporary community standards. And when it comes to something like that, it really does matter who's in charge of the FCC, who's appointing the staff to make these decisions, who the other commissioners are. Because what a contemporary community standard is in one household, you know, or one neighborhood or one town or one state really depends. So the FCC does have a lot of power in that way to move the bar. And I think you will see in the coming months a number of fines, probably mostly for radio, but also for television, that will signal some sort of a shift about what is indecent and what isn't. Under Michael Powell, the former FCC chairman, it was somewhat muddied where the line lay. And Martin has promised to really make it clear and to make it a line that will make these groups that form the Republican Party and the president's base more happy.
It's very clear that in not too long a time, no television will be distributed the way it is now, and that presumably all of this stuff will be coming in through a variety of different pipes to a variety of different devices. When that time arrives, whether it's in 5 years or in 15 years, will the FCC or the government really have any dog in this fight when consumers are absolutely in control of what they watch and when?
That's an open question you just asked. The government, though, at this moment, both in Congress and the executive branch, seems to be moving in the direction of saying definitively, yes, we will be involved in those discussions. Just because you're paying to get it, you're choosing to give money to get this stuff in your homes, does not mean that government shouldn't be involved.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Michael Shearer is the Washington correspondent for Salon.com.
What's in a name? For the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, names, or domain names, are the way to organize a chaotic global internet. But the task of assigning domain names and the content those names imply, .com, .net, and .org, for example, also is increasingly political. ICANN was created by the U.S. government, and despite international representatives on its board, ICANN ultimately still answers to the U.S. Department of Commerce. But the department has never used that authority until last month. That was when a 5-year-old plan to generate a new domain name suddenly ignited new outrage, mostly from the Christian right. The new domain name was to be .xxx, designated specifically for internet porn. After a deluge of 6,000 letters, the Commerce Department stepped in to halt ICANN's imminent passage of .xxx. But according to Brett Fawcett, a lawyer and advisor to ICANN, opposition to the new domain name extended far beyond America's borders.
There were also some governments that wrote to ICANN. ICANN has a body known as the Government Advisory Committee, on which representatives of the world's government sit. And some of the people who were opposed to it included the board member from China, board member from Mexico. If you look at where people came from who voted against it, they come from countries that I think you could fairly describe as more conservative.
Could you sum up what the argument against the .xxx domain name would be? It seems to me that if you put all the porn guys there, you'd be able to identify them and perhaps even regulate them ultimately.
You know, politics truly does make strange bedfellows, because on both sides of this issue, we find conservative groups and pro-pornography groups who don't want to see .xxx come into being. From the conservative side are those who think that a top-level domain specifically devoted to adult content would somehow give it legitimacy that it shouldn't have. The pornographers who are on that side don't want a .xxx because they don't want to be ghettoized into a .xxx. They want to stay in .com. And on the other side of the equation, you have people who are in favor of it, who include conservative family groups who think that, yes, having a segregated area for XXX and adult content would be a very good thing for families and children. And you also have pornographers who think it would be a good thing because it'd give them another brand.
So let's unpack these arguments for and against .XXX. People on the Christian right or the conservative groups who oppose this domain are, well, at the very least, a bit naive if they think that the pornography business needs the legitimacy of a particular domain name to be strong.
I think it is naive, but I think that there really is a segment of the community, you find this view all over the world, that believes that once you give it an official label accessible to anyone in the world, that that elevates it in status and somehow makes it acceptable. I don't agree with that view, but I understand it.
And when the pornographers say they don't want it because it'll ghettoize them, this is voluntary. So far, at least, the proposal has them able to keep their .com domain name along with the .XXX, so it seems to me there wouldn't be any ghettoization going on.
Absolutely. The proposal right now is voluntary. But, you know, I think it's naive for the people who are in favor of it not to think that governments are going to piggyback on top of .XXX with national laws requiring adult content to move into .XXX.
Is that because once they're all in XXX, you can start imposing controls on XXX? At least Sandra Day O'Connor said that the .com world is virtually unpoliceable.
That's exactly the point. And if you go back 10 years when Congress was first dealing with adult content on the internet, they passed something called the Communications Decency Act. This went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and the court said, this is unconstitutional. And one of the opinions that's often looked to for the greatest weight is Sandra Day O'Connor's opinion. And she said, you know, the Communications Decency Act isn't constitutional now, but maybe someday we'll be able to zone the internet the same way we zone adult businesses out of, you know, areas where there are school children, areas where there are churches, areas where there are families. She said, we're not there yet, but maybe someday we'll get there. And I think that if .XXX passes, and I still think it will, over the next 3 or 4 years, you're going to see many, many nations pass laws requiring pornographic content to move into .XXX.
All right. Brett, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Brett Fawcett is an attorney and an advisor to ICANN, representing internet users.
Coming up, boundaries between fantasy and reality blur in real-life sports and online gaming.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 25 years ago, fantasy sports were born. Well, it was just baseball back then, and it wasn't called fantasy. It was called rotisserie. But in the years since, the concept has expanded to football, basketball, golf, etc. Today, it's a multi-million-dollar industry said to be second only to porn as an internet cash cow. And like porn, it allows you to imagine yourself in a position real life will never deliver you. In this case, owner and general manager of your own pro team. Each year, at the beginning of every season, fantasy owners convene in person or online to draft players from professional rosters to assemble their own virtual squads. During the season, owners get credit for their draftees' achievements, touchdowns, sacks, homers, strikeouts, goals, whatever. If you drafted Derek Lee to be your first baseman, you're in clover. If you drafted Jim Tomei, who in real life was injured all season, you're screwed. For the thrill of virtual victory and the agony of virtual defeat, we can thank one man, Daniel Okrent. Yes, he's been on the program before in his role as public editor of the New York Times, but today he joins me as Rotisserie Baseball's founding father, reminiscing on how it all began.
I was on a plane from Hartford, Connecticut to Austin, Texas, and bored, and came up with an idea. And then I forced myself out into the world and proposed it to a few friends, and they liked the idea, except for those who didn't like the idea. And off we went. It was called Rotisserie because we had our first meetings in a now-defunct restaurant in New York called La Rotisserie Française.
Now, we're talking 1979, 1980. There were box scores in the paper every day, enabling rotisserie participants to find out how his roster had performed. But there was sure no internet. I gather that the development of the internet changed everything.
It did, although I want to take credit for one other change in media. If you talk to people who worked at USA Today, which was starting around that time, they will tell you that because they ran expanded box scores with much more detail than those which ran in most newspapers, that really got the newspaper off the ground. It's the thing that made people, more than anything else, actually buy USA Today. One of the consequences of that, in time, is that most daily papers began to run extended box scores as well.
With all due credit to USA Today, let's talk about the internet and its effect on what is now known as fantasy sports.
Right.
How dramatic was that effect?
Enormous. I think that the game was pretty popular through the 80s and into the early 90s. But when the internet arrived and enabled people to get their statistics instantaneously, enabled them to join leagues with people around the country, enabled them to turn over their entire lives to this endeavor, it really moved into the millions who play it. Another media institution where the principals have told me that it had enormous effect was ESPN.com. At least early on in ESPN.com's history, maybe the first 3-4 years, 80% of its traffic came from people playing fantasy sports. And I believe that's the same at Sportsline and at SI.com.
When you came up with Rotisserie Baseball, it happened that you were in the media and writing for magazines and so forth. Did your ties to the media in any way contribute to the craze catching on?
Unquestionably. My original league, I think of the 10 of us, 8 of us were in the media. Because we were in the media, we knew other people in the media. That led to feature stories about us in newspapers and appearances on the Today Show and CBS Morning News. And that really was the first step in popularizing, making people aware of it. And secondarily, in 1981, during the baseball strike, this was the second season of Rotisserie, by then there was a Rotisserie game in nearly every press box in the major leagues. The people from various newspapers, radio stations, TV stations would play amongst themselves. And then when the strike came in the summer of 1981, they had nothing to write about. There was no baseball going on. Football hadn't started. So nearly every sports columnist filled one of his or her 3 times a week slots with a story about their Rotisserie league. And from there, it zoomed.
All right, Dan. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, I hope it works out.
Author and journalist Daniel Okrent dreamed up Rotisserie Baseball. Once upon a time, sports fans were devoted to teams, but fantasy sports fans live or die by the fortunes of players who may or may not be on their favorite teams. Let's say you're a Philadelphia Phillies loyalist checking the box score to see how Bobby Abreu did last night. Hey, 3-for-4 with a homer and 4 RBIs. But wait, he did that against John Paterson of the Nationals, the ace of your fantasy pitching staff. Are you happy or are you sad? For the answer, we turn not to a sports writer, but a fantasy sports writer. Matthew Berry, also known as the talented Mr. Roto, doesn't hang out in press boxes, but he has his own website, a column in Sporting News, a radio show in Los Angeles, and a TV presence on such shows as ESPN's Cold Pizza. Matthew joins me now from a fantasy sports conference in Las Vegas. He says that from where he sits, among several TVs watching several games, fantasy has not changed the reality of how sports are covered.
It's basically statistic and player-based. So that's always been the case. Since the advent of cable television and, frankly, SportsCenter, it's about the dunks and the home runs or the touchdown celebrations. It's not about the great offensive line play. And, well, you know, frankly, welcome to the world. You know, if Peyton Manning throws three touchdowns on Sunday, that's going to get covered regardless of whether it has an impact fantasy-wise or not. That's the lead story of the Colts game.
Is it doing anything to the nature of fandom so that the attention is now off of teams and only on individual players who, you know, happen to be performing in team sports?
If anything, it's just increased awareness and appreciation for the sport. I'm a huge Washington Redskins fan, so I'm always going to watch the Redskins. But if I didn't play fantasy football, that's all I would do, is I would just watch the Redskins game. But because I play fantasy football, I have a rooting interest in every single NFL game. How did my player do? How did the guy I'm playing, his players do?
You raise an interesting question, and that is of conflict of interest. When the Skins are playing a team with one or two or several of your fantasy league players on it, do you stop rooting for the Skins and start rooting for your fantasy team players to perform well against the Redskins?
No. It's the Redskins above all else. But, you know, the Redskins can win a game 7-0, or they can win it 35-34. It's still a victory for the Redskins. So if my fantasy players happen to do well against the Redskins, I don't have a problem with that. I have heard the argument that it says that, well, people start rooting for their players instead of teams. But you know what? In a case like that, it just basically means your fandom and relationship with the team isn't that strong, and the team hasn't done enough to warrant your fandom. And it's easy to point the finger at fantasy leaguers, but, you know, trust me, people that are playing fantasy sports, they are huge sports fans. They want something to root for.
Okay, point taken. However, I must share a little from my personal experience. I was in a fantasy baseball league, and I am a lifelong Philadelphia Phillies fan, but I didn't have a great number of Phillies on my fantasy team roster. And I would go to the Phillies box score, and I would see that Jim Thome had hit two home runs and knocked in six. And instead of going, oh, yeah, Jim Thome, Philadelphia Phillies, I was going, oh, my God, I just got behind six runs in the RBI race and, you know, two homers in the home run race because he was competing against my slugger. Has the purity of my fandom been compromised by fantasy sports?
It would sound that way. My argument is that's sort of on you. For a guy that watches as much Phillies baseball and is a lifelong fan you are, how you could be depressed that Jim Thome hits two home runs and six RBIs for Phillies is beyond me.
I feel weak and small after 45 years of suffering at the expense of the Philadelphia Phillies.
Phillies fans have a tough lot in life as it is, so I don't mean to pile on. But I will say this. At the end of the day, in a macro sense, I think it's okay. I mean, because like from Major League Baseball's point of view, you're paying closer attention to that game. You care about that game. You're a passionate fan. What's wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with that. That's the part I don't get when I hear that kind of criticism.
All right, one final question. What should I do about David Bell?
You're still hanging on to him?
I think you've answered my question. Matthew, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Matthew Berry, also known as the Talented Mr. Roto, can be found at talentedmrroto.com.
This month, police in Japan arrested a Chinese student for mugging other players in a massive multiplayer online role-playing game called Lineage 2. How did the student do it? Well, every player in these games has an online character or avatar, but the games are also populated by software robots or bots that look like avatars. In this case, the student used a bot to steal virtual equipment from other players' avatars to sell for real cash offline. If this gives you a headache, get used to it. This week, another game, the World of Warcraft, reached more than 1 million players in North America, a continental first. More players means more participants in the virtual economy, where real dollars can buy virtual goods that can better help you navigate the game world. In fact, you can even invest in these fantasy realms. In December, an Australian gamer paid 26,500 real dollars for a virtual island in the game project Entropia. He's already made more than $9,000 off that land by parceling it off and levying taxes. What's going on here? Indiana University Associate Professor Edward Castronova is an expert in this virtual economy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Brooke. It's exciting to be on NPR.
Now, why would people spend real money for these virtual products?
Well, for the same reasons you might want a car. Okay, in the real world, an automobile allows you to get to places you can't go to otherwise. You have to understand that cyberspace is being built out in a fantastic, massive, immersive frontier. You can't just log into one of these games and instantly see all the things that are in there. You have to acquire certain items and powers to see more of the stuff. And let's remember, these are dreamscapes. These are fantasy places. Ask yourself, if someone built a world based on your personal fantasy, would you want to go? How much of it would you want to see?
So when you entered Norrath, the world of EverQuest, your avatar started out probably as fairly puny, as new avatars do. Did you find yourself in this position? There were places you wanted to go, you couldn't get there from here?
Well, certainly. I mean, my first reaction to this world was I could tell there were people in it, and there was a lot of energy. There was all this running around and socializing and trading. And so my first thought was, I want to explore and just see what these people are doing. I walked out of the city and was killed by a rat in 30 seconds. And that immediately set me on the process of saying, well, if I'm going to be a scout, if I'm going to be the Amerigo Vespucci of this world, I need to get a good ship, right? I need to have equipment and resources. And that set me on the process of building up my character.
And you build up your character by vanquishing enemies, by taking their money or their weapons and so forth, becoming stronger. Now, that takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. The point of this virtual exchange is you can cut that time in half or eliminate that time altogether. In fact, you can now buy a fully formed avatar that comes fully loaded like a car and just take it for a spin in Norrath.
What that trade takes advantage of is the fact that these are products on the internet, so they're globally available. And that means folks with pretty low wage rates can use their time to build things up. And then if a Westerner decides to pay them the equivalent of, you know, I don't know, $5 an hour for the task of building up a character or acquiring gold pieces, you know, $3 to $5 an hour isn't great money for us, but there are people in Thailand and China and Korea who are actually making good money just farming these worlds for gold pieces and characters and selling them to us.
In fact, there's a number of these, I guess you would call them vendors of these virtual products and characters. One called GamersLoot.net actually employs people in Romania for a few dollars a day to build up high-level characters, and then they're sold off for big profits. These sorts of operations are considered sweatshops.
I'm not saying that the deals these folks are getting are fair. On the other hand, it is making money with a video game. I'm just trying to remain neutral on this. I've heard arguments on both sides. I think the way this market actually works is not so much on the sweatshop model. I think it's a cottage industry model, a vast army of people working more or less independently. And while they're casually playing the game, every once in a while, they might put a little more effort into acquiring gold pieces because they know, hey, you know, I can sell them on eBay and, you know, buy that car stereo that I wanted. My own personal opinion is that most of this commercial activity outside the game is actually a real pain because the point is not to, you know, spend a lot of money and get ahead. That's the game we're playing out here, right?
Yeah.
The point inside the game is to have, for example, an economy within a level playing field. Wouldn't that be exciting, where everyone starts out with nothing and the only way you advance is your own work?
Meanwhile, though, you have a lot of people who are still being ripped off in transactions for virtual goods. Mm. In the gaming world, there's a trend towards lawlessness, land prospecting, get-rich-quick schemes. Basically, it seems to be the virtual version of the Wild West.
I agree with that. That's my favorite metaphor for what's happening. This is a frontier town. There are hucksters. There are evangelists. There are scholars. There are, you know, guys who just dig imposing law and order. And the whole debate about human society and how we should live together is alive and vibrant. That's because in the virtual world, there are actual items of value that are being negotiated. We're talking about access. We're talking about fun. We're talking about self-development, self-esteem, social connections, reputation. All that stuff is in play there. And since there is no government sitting over it right now, everybody feels like they have a right to have a voice. And boy, do they use it.
Who should govern this world when it becomes less and less separate from the real one?
Well, we have laws on the books that create fantasies right now. They're called corporations. The law treats them as people, but they're fictional people. It serves a social purpose to create these fantasy human beings under certain rights and responsibilities. So I think there would have to be an international agreement on the legal status of fantasy worlds. And what I would advocate is a law not of incorporation, but interration. In other words, the creation of new land, terra nova, where the idea is we will create fantasy spaces. Anybody who creates them has certain responsibilities. So, for example, you can't allow people to launder money from terrorism and crime in these places. They have to be sealed off from the rest of the world. That's a responsibility. But in return, the right of the owner is to regulate it as if it's its own country.
One last question then. What if the creator of that world decides, I'm done, turns the switch, and wipes out a population of millions thereby?
What that person would be doing actually would be destroying not only economic assets that could amount to hundreds of millions of dollars, but more importantly, a human society, a series of relationships that for some people are increasingly becoming their only society. In other words, their friendship network, their families of choice. And I think the law is going to have to say, well, if you're running one of these things, you have a responsibility. If you want to get out of this business, you've got to turn the asset over to the users. You know, turning off the server would be the equivalent of going to a small town where everyone knows everyone else and forcibly picking them all up and scattering them all over the earth. There's a real human emotional cost to that, and I don't think it should be left to happen that way.
Edward, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Edward Castronova is associate professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University. His new book, Synthetic Worlds, The Business and Culture of Online Games, hits bookstores this fall.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Sarah Dalsimer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.